Self, I'm Gomila. I'm a fellow at the Lauterbach Center, and it is my great honor today and pleasure to welcome Professor Tanja Alberts, who has come all the way from Amsterdam. Professor Alberts is Professor of Law and Politics at the Department of Transnational Legal Studies Amsterdam. She is the author of many publications on the interplay between politics and law within the global governance, misrecognition, colonial treaties. She's the author of a book on constructing sovereignty between politics and law, and co-author of another book, The Changing Practices of International Law, which is a very important issue nowadays. I think international law is changing even more. The topic of Professor Alberts' lecture today will be rubber boats, transnational legal encounters in the Mediterranean. So the topic speaks for itself. Let me just add in general that Professor Alberts will focus on the maritime duty to rescue anyone in distress at sea, which has been codified in international treaties. And she will also discuss in particular, as I understand, the non-refoulement principle under refugee and human rights law as it applies to these situations. So my warm welcome, and we look forward to your lecture.
Thank you so much, Joanna, and thank you to Lena and Juliana and the Lauterbach Center for inviting me for this talk today and to present my paper at your famous, I can say, Friday lunch in Mars. So the title of my paper is full of fancy concepts, and I realize that it's even a little bit different from the one that's on the program, so that adds more concepts. But in the paper, I try to weave several points together, so let me start by highlighting that. The first thing is analyzing law as action rather than as rules in the books or law in action. The second one is to talk about the interaction of the entanglement between international law and international relations through politics of protection, and then focusing on how these dynamics play out in the Mediterranean. And then last but not least, focus on the role of objects in this politics of protection that is happening in transnational legal encounters, which was on the a concept that was also on the program. So I use this concept.
Is it not moving?
Yeah, there we go. The concept of transnational legal counters as a way to analyze the relationship and dynamics between people, rules, and objects. And through this concept or heuristic, I try to bring these three points together. Now, rather than working top-down from the concepts and the theories or theoretical orientations, I would like to proceed from the bottom-up. So I will go into this case study of the rubber boats on the Mediterranean to explore their role in rescue operations and interaction between the law of the sea and the principle of the duty to rescue with refugee law and human rights law. And then actually how people on these migrant boats are being protected or actually are subject to a politics of protection. So let me start by introducing Kay Longstaff. Kay Longstaff was a British tourist, and she was sailing on a Norwegian cruise ship, the Adriatic Sea, in 2017, I believe. The 20th of August, she fell off the ship around midnight. As soon as they discovered, the staff discovered, the cruise ship returned, tried to find her. Ultimately, she was rescued in the morning around 9:30 by a Croatian Coast Guard. And you see a picture of her here in the Guardian with her rescues. 5 days before, there were 1,900 people on a migrant boat that had to be rescued. They were in distress near Lampedusa by an Italian ship called the Ubaldi Pidgiotti. When the ship rescued them, the Italian Minister of Interior, Salvini, refused the ship to disembark the rescuees. And the ship was sailing for 11 days before ultimately it got permission to disembark on the 26th of August in Catania. Now, both these events fall under the maritime duty to rescue people in distress. And this has been codified in many treaties, one of them being the SAR Treaty, where it explicitly say that everyone has the right to be rescued without discrimination of their nationality, the circumstances in which they are found. And still, of course, it's quite clear that Kay and these 190 anonymous migrants had a very different encounter with this principle and with international law. So despite the non-discrimination principle and despite the notion of the madam migrant that we know from Grotius, clearly this high seas, the free sea, is a differentiated space with a stratified mobility, which creates a politics of protection, which we will explore in this presentation. So, to move to another famous example, the Left to Die boat case that you might have heard about. It's reported by Forensic Architecture. This boat, I think I need to, yeah. I show here in the background, I show stills from the video that was made, Liquid Traces, by Forensic Architecture. And what you see here is the journey of this boat leaving from the Libyan coast, trying to reach one of the Italian islands. It was 14 days adrift in the spring of 2011. 63 of the 72 passengers died, including two babies that were born aboard and their mothers. This was also the time of the Libyan revolt. So these borders were the most closely surveyed areas of Europe, well, not Europe, but of the area at the time. Because there was an arms embargo, there was a no-fly zone, there was a military intervention. This was all authorized under the NATO Operation Unified Protector, which was mandated under the Security Council Resolution 1973. In the preamble, it states that the rationale for the operation was concern for the safety of the Libyan citizens, but also, and here I quote, reiterates the Council's concern at the plight of the refugees forced to flee the violence, end of quote. The operation's mandate, though, was a little bit more narrow in terms of its focus on the protection of the civilians within Libya. But here is a picture of what I was just saying, that this was the most closely surveyed waters in the world at this time, because these were all the ships that were taking care of enforcing the embargo. So there were 38 warships in the area, and there was surveillance by airplanes as well as via satellites. What Forensic Architecture did is that they used all this surveillance data to track which ships were near The Left to Die, or the boat that was later baptized the Left to Die boat, and must have seen it on its radars, and hence actually had the duty to come to their rescue, but ignored that. So what we seem to end up with here is a rather familiar confrontation between security logics on one hand and law on the other, or what political scientists like to call a zero-sum game, right? Where we have law and security in opposition. What I do in my paper is that I rather would like to question this very strict ontological separation between reality and international law, between politics and law, and to look into how international law is implicated in these processes. So I take a performative approach and analyze here law as action, world-making powers of law. And in this paper, then I also don't just focus on international law as an elite affair, but focus on the everyday workings of law, because as we all know, most of international law doesn't make it to court. So most of it actually happens on the ground. So here comes in the notion of transnational legal encounters. So let's very briefly explore that. So the idea is to explore the everyday life of law as a concrete encounter of people, rules, and objects. So here is from the Collins Dictionary, a description of what an encounter is. And from this, you can translate this into a lens where a transnational legal encounter offers a lens to investigate law as, on the one hand, a concrete event, a lived experience, which is relational. It always includes a meeting of two things or people. And it often involves a kind of a confrontation or a struggle. And this you can get from the Latin root of incontra, where there is some kind of struggle, confrontation. What transnational legal encounters are looking at the workings of law through transnational legal encounters also really gets us to the particular time and place of the encounter where law is operating. And we will see that in the case as well. So what this leads to is a dual understanding of law as both acting in and acting upon the world. So this is the performative approach. And this you might be familiar with from, for instance, Twill or Pahucha's work on international law as law and encounters. It also enables me to focus on international law as part, or these transnational legal encounters as part of a larger transnational force field, which includes different legal regimes, different rules, political alliances, the world economy, commercial interests, EU policies, and national political struggles that all come together in these very concrete meetings of peoples with international law. And as I already said, I am very particularly interested in the role of objects in this encounter. So how international law can do its work and the role that objects play in this. As the lived reality of international law, and as you already said, I will focus on how the principle of non-refoulement, which I will discuss in a moment, actually plays out in the encounter of the rubber boats, and how actually the rubber boats play a role in how these migrants are no longer protected under the non-refoulement principle. Okay, so that in terms of a little conceptual discussion. But now let's move on a little bit further on this focus on materiality. And you might be familiar with the material turns in both international relations and international law. And to look back at the roots of the material focus also of the law of the seas. And materiality already played a role early on. Also, when Hugo Grotius was introducing the Mare Liberum.
So the Mare Liberum, as you probably are aware, emerged as a legal category at a moment when the sea became politically and economically relevant. And here, too, we can recognize a politics of protection at play, in particular with regard to the Treaty of Tordesillas, through which Spain and Portugal divided up the world in amongst themselves. And as we know, this is when Grotius came up with the idea of the Mare Liberum in order to secure the Dutch access to the Indies. And he distinguished between terra firma and the open seas as a free universal space through where he actually, the argument was, it's the materiality of the waves, which means that we can actually not create borders at sea because they are too flexible and they are, in his words, insusceptible of physical appropriation. As such, through this materiality, it means that they belong to mankind as a whole. And mankind, as the so-called jus communicationis, which is the natural right of mankind, and you can read states in his again, to travel, trade, and evangelize. Now, this jus communicationis found its way into our modern law of the sea. In the secularized version, this became the freedom to navigate, explore, and exploit the high seas. Now, this freedom for everyone to go onto the sea is not an absolute freedom because it is connected to the old maritime duty to protect life at sea. And this is an individual duty for each and every captain to rescue people in distress at sea. So this is a universal obligation under customary law. It's codified in another convention, the SOLAS convention, amongst other things, as well as in UNCLOS, actually, where it is stated very clearly that the master of a ship has this duty towards everyone. And again, it's the non-discrimination principle as well, you see, formulated here. Now, the first version of SOLAS, this is a little side note, emerged in 1914, which was as a response to the Titanic accident. So if you read SOLAS, you can really recognize this because there is a duty to inform other ships when meeting dangerous ice. And there's also the establishment of an international ice patrol. And this is all in Chapter 5, SOLAS. But the main focus of this convention is on safety on board of commercial ships. So it sets a lot of safety standards with regard to construction and equipment of ships. But of course, nowadays, the most vulnerable people at sea are not those sailing on cruise ships or on commercial ships, but they are the irregular migrants sailing on rubber boats. And analyzing this, we then, of course, come to be quite quickly to the conclusion that this natural right of mankind to move on the seas is differentiated in practice. And here I would like to show a mural by Banksy in Calais. It's called We're Not on the Same Boat, to actually illustrate this. It was inspired by the La Dodo de Medusa, the painting. And basically what you see here, it's not only the right to move on the high seas, but it's also the right to be rescued that is differentiated on the sea. Now, this again seems to end up in this clash between security and law that we earlier discussed. And it could remind us of what Michel Foucault said about security. about maximizing movement of the positive elements while minimizing what is perceived to be risky and inconvenient. So again, it seems to be security versus law. But the main point is that it's not just the movement, but it's also this right to be rescued that seems to be differentiated. And the fact that some elements are considered risky and convenient is because of international law. It's because of international rules. So law actually is implicated in this in terms of who or what is considered to be risky. The fact that it's not just the right to move, but also the right to be rescued that is differentiated can be illustrated by another example of two coincidences, more recent ones that you probably will remember, the Titanic sub and all the operations that went on in order to try and rescue people on board of this submarine versus a migrant shipwreck that was actually happening at the very same time. And here is a cartoon on this. Okay, so as I said, it seems that again and again we end up with this clash between security and law, but actually it is the migrant boats that are too risky because of an intersection with another legal duty of care, namely the right to asylum and the principle of non-refoulement that you also already referred to. Very briefly, what is the principle of non-refoulement about? This is that you cannot send people back to a situation where their lives are at risk. I'm sure you are familiar with this. Now, what the point is that this is the clash, or this is the principle that makes these migrant boats risky. But not only that, it's also international law itself that provides captains and states with legal escapes to try and escape their duty to rescue. And here in the paper, I borrow from Fleur Jones's very captive statement that international law rules in a or orders in an unruly manner. So what is this unruly manner through which international law operates? The point with the maritime duty to rescue is that it's a so-called imperfect duty. So every captain has it, but no one in particular has it. And there is a lot of unclarity in terms of the disembarkation. So it's clear that everyone has the right to rescue, but there's no rules in terms of then where do you disembark them. And there's different logics that you could come up with. Right? One is, well, the nearest port or the next port of call, right, for commercial ships that would cost them less if they can just continue their journey. You could also use the logic of the flag ship, under whose flag is the ship sailing. So then that's where the rescue is brought. So there was a lot of diplomatic standstills. There are a lot of diplomatic standstills because people, the states applying different logics or relying on different logics. And because of this unclarity, the International Maritime Organization decided to make amendments to the rules and to create more clarity in terms of the so-called SAR zones. SAR stands for search and rescue. So what we see is, in a sense, a territorialization of the sea through which there is more clarity about which states has the ultimate responsibility to coordinate the rescue operation. So that's very important. It's about ultimate responsibility to coordinate the rescue operations. And here you see that map. In a sense, you could say it reminds a little bit of the situation with Tordesillas, but whereas with Tordesillas, the attempt was to claim ownership over the sea, here they use the borders in order to distribute responsibility. So it has nothing to do with ownership, but it actually has to do with sovereignty as a responsibility to rescue. So in principle, one would say, well, this provides for clarity and hence better protection for people in distress at sea. Similarly, to these amendments to the SAR regime, we have the famous Hirschi case in 2012 of the European Court of Human Rights that also seemed to improve the protection for the irregular migrants. This was a case in which Italy actually tried to mobilize the fragmentation of international law to escape their responsibility for people that were rescued. Basically, they were saying, so they rescued people and then they sent them to Libya. So the case was then about, were they allowed to send them to Libya or were they then violating the principle of non-movement because we knew about Libya and the slave markets and all of that. But Italy said, well, we were operating this case under the search and rescue regime. We were operating under the law of the sea. We were not operating under refugee law. This is separate, right? So because this was a rescue operation, we could disembark them wherever was convenient, and we did not have to deal with the non-refoulement principle because that's refugee law, and we were not in such an operation. The court did not accept this, and they said the non-refoulement principle applies as soon as the migrants come under the continuous and exclusive control of state authority, either at land or at sea. And as soon as they are under the control of the state, the responsibility to protect is triggered. That was exactly the word I was looking for. So basically what we have is that the court did not allow Italy to use this fragmentation of sea, but actually show that this is an intersection and we have multiple layers of law that just build on each other. And the human rights also have extraterritorial scope. Right? So you cannot say it's only when you enter the territory that you can actually file for asylum and the non-refoulement principle applies, but as soon as you come under the control, and of course, if you are rescued and you're on a boat, you're clearly under the control of the authority of that boat. So again, this intersection of these different regimes, or the fragmentation, actually seems to create better layers of protection for the refugees, right? Because Italy was not allowed to use it as a way to escape their responsibility. However, attempts to further legalize paradoxically creates opportunities to assume responsibility and increasing the politics of international law. This is actually something that the book that you refer to, The Changing Practices of International Law, that I edited with Thomas Gammeltoft Hansen, we are exploring this paradox. So how more and more law is not reducing politics, which would be the zero-sum logic, but actually more and more law increases opportunities to escape responsibilities through law. So then law is actually part of this. Okay, so now let's look into and more concretely into how this happens, this paradox. One of the ways in which this happens is that the universal duty to rescue people in distress at sea that every captain has, the old maritime principle, has turned into a particular obligation in practice. So whereas the SAR zones and the new rules regarding search and rescue try to create clarity, the way that it has been used in practice by states is that rather than saying, so it's still the individual responsibility of each captain, they now say, we're in the multi-SAR zone, Malta, it's your duty. This is not formally how it's arranged, but this is how it's being used in practice. Yeah. So the SAR zones then, the clarity that was created through the zones, now offer an opportunity for the states to actually look at the SAR state as having the primary responsibility. Say, well, it's up to you, right? We don't need to do this anymore. Moreover, when ships come across rubber boats, they often hand out some water and biscuits and maybe some fuel, which seems like a humanitarian thing to do. But what it does in practice is that it separates Part A of Article 89, which is about rendering assistance to people, from Part B, which is about rescuing people in distress. Moreover, practically, what this could mean is if you give people in a boat some fuel, they might make it to another SAR zone, and hence you can shift the responsibility to another state. So in that sense, you could say that water and fuel seem like humanitarian objects and related to fulfilling your obligation, the duty of care, your maritime duty of care, but actually they also turn it in a way in which you can actually escape your responsibility because you can facilitate that a boat actually reaches another SAR zone. In terms of these boats, these dinghies, they are generally fabricated in China, and they are transshipped to Libya via Malta and Turkey. And there has been research that shows that in between 2012 and 2016, there was for 1.3 million euros of imported dinghies, a total of more than 5,000 pieces. And they were sold on Alibaba as high-quality refugee boats. You cannot find this anymore. It has been taken down. I found some further advertisement that I put in the article, but they were sold as high-quality refugee boats. Now, what is important is that this practice of using rubber boats was actually increased or really emerged as a consequence of EU Operation Sophia. You might recall that the EU, at a certain point, that there used to be like ferry services, like big wooden boats, and the smugglers would basically have a ferry service back and forth between, for instance, Libya and Europe. But with Operation Sophia, the EU decided to destroy the wooden boats. So this was not very attractive anymore commercially. So this is when the smugglers decided to shift to rubber boats that they didn't need to use, that they only need to use once, and to make the migrants kept them off their own ship, so to speak. Now, the effect of the rubber boats, of this change of practice, is that the migrants very often don't make it beyond the Libyan SAR zone. And if they don't make it to the Libyan SAR zone and they are rescued by the Libyan government can take them back to Libya. And it's not a violation of the non-refoulement principle. So through this usage of the rubber boats, the migrants actually are no longer protected under the principle of non-refoulement, which they would be if they had met if they had been picked up in the Italian SAR zone, for instance. So this also puts a different light on another aspect of what used to be EU Operation Sophia, which was on the training of the Libyan Coast Guards and the setting up of maritime rescue coordination centers. This is an obligation under search and rescue. Each coastal state needs to have such a center to coordinate the rescue operations. But for European states, this is also a way to avoid the encounter with the migrant boats and to make sure this all falls under Libyan authority, again, limiting or even limiting down to zero the protection under the non-refoulement principle for the migrants. The key role of the boat, also comes out in a discussion on what it actually means to be in distress. So what can trigger this right and duty to be rescued? And I have a quote here from a senior officer of the Armed Forces of Malta. Distress is the imminent danger of loss of lives. So if they are sinking, it is distress. If the boat is not sinking, it's not in distress, even if it's 6 meters long and has 30 people on board. What this means is that the very moment, the very time of the encounter becomes very crucial, whether you can mobilize the right to be rescued. If it's not sinking at the very right moment, you cannot mobilize it, and the captain can do away with humanitarian assistance in terms of water and fuel. So the boat becomes a crucial object in this transnational encounter, and it might limit the possibilities for protection under international law itself. And there have been stories of migrants actually self-destroying their rubber boat just so that they could actually trigger the right to be rescued, or the duty for the captain. So international law is at work in all these instances, but the impacts are very different from the protection that the rules seek to provide due to this interplay between rules, people, and objects, and the interplay between law and politics. Now, let me finish with a piece of art by Ai Weiwei. This piece of art consists of 300 oversized refugee figures in a big boat that hangs from the ceiling. And just like the boat, the art piece, it's the life of the refugee that hangs in balance. Ai Weiwei calls this artwork the law of the journey. And through this piece, it wants to show that the migration crisis, first of all, is a human crisis. Now, if we link this to the idea of the mare liberum as the legal space of mankind, the jus communitationis, the law of the journey could reflect the modern jus communitationis, whose legal framework makes part of humankind subject to the politics of protection. And in the course of their journey, the boats turn from commercial objects as sold on Alibaba to either a criminal or a humanitarian object. So the humanitarian object in the sense that it allows refugees to flee from their situation, a criminal object because, of course, the Italian government has been criminalizing the smuggling. And also one that ultimately then can preclude its passengers from the protection by the non-refoulement principle. And they can then turn from a floating refuge to an offshore carceral space, or ultimately a floating graveyard, to use the terms by Streel and Dalmeida. In terms of the material, for those of you who are working on materiality in international law, it reminds of Jane Bennett's work on fibered materiality and key actants, so where the boats actually start to play a role in this encounter. When only after Ai Weiwei finished his piece of art, he discovered that the rubber that he used for his artwork came from the same Chinese company that sold the rubber boats on Alibaba. And this adds another critical layer to the artwork and the politics of protection at work in the transnational legal encounters. It ultimately reflects how the low quality of the rubber of the boats means that the boat people cannot be protected by the non-refoulement principle. Thank you.